Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we're going to start. I know we're already into the summer, so I'm sure we're going to have a smaller crowd than usual. Although, in general, most people listen to us, more people that is, listen to us after the live show than do listen to us live, so that's okay. In case I forget, let me just say at the end of class, let me just say now, today's the last class of the semester. Again, it's been a very good semester. I thank you all for being with us, including the new people who've been on and the people who listen to us who are not with us live. We were able to do a lot. I learned a lot thanks to your questions and comments. And like I said, I hope you learned a lot also. We did five classes on Chaim Ozer-Gozinski, a bit of a sixth. There is no book on Rav Chaim Ozer-Gozinski. We could have spent even more classes on him. I think that should suffice to show that he's a fascinating figure, and there certainly is room for a book, not an art scroll type of book, but a real biography, one that is the newspapers of Vilna, and really get a sense of the time that he lived. Before we begin with Rabbi Eliel ben Amozig, another fascinating figure, and one who, really in the last 20 years, as I'll mention, has become quite popular. Some people are more popular in their lifetime. In fact, most people are more popular in their lifetime than afterwards. I've mentioned throughout the years we've been on numerous Gedolim who were outstanding figures and internationally known, great reputations, and today, very few people have even heard of them. So that's the typical thing. However, there are examples of people who were no great during their lifetime and after their deaths even increase even more in popularity. And I've mentioned a few times Rav Soloveitchik is a perfect example of that. He's more popular now than in his lifetime. And then there are those who were not so popular in their lifetime or so influential, but after their deaths become quite influential and popular. And also, we'll talk about Ben Amozig. He had some popularity during his lifetime, and then he became totally unknown at 80 years, and now there's been a revival of interest in him. But since it's the last class, I do want to finish these things that I've had on my desk for a while. I wanted to tell you about, and also just respond to a few questions before we move into Eliel ben Amozig. We'll only do the first class, obviously, today, and we'll continue, God willing, in the fall. So let me just go through them in no particular order, all of which I think are interesting, though. We'll hope you do as well. In researching Rav Chaim Ozer-Gozinski, and as I mentioned, there's no book about him, so unlike other topics where I had sort of stuff to help, articles or books that really helped me with Rav Chaim Ozer, I had to create everything from scratch. There is I have it here now, a little magazine, rabbinic magazine, called Achiezer that came out a few times. It was named after Rav Chaim Ozer, and it was sort of like a magazine. The person wanted to make money by people sponsoring it. He knew Rav Chaim Ozer, but in one of the issues, this is volume 3 and 4, he tells a story, and it's not clear if the punchline comes from Rav Chaim Ozer-Gozinski or comes from Rav Yaakov Weinberg, because there's a skip in the line. But it doesn't matter, because the important thing is the punchline, not the person who said it. And I think it's Rav Chaim Ozer, though it's not 100% clear. But this is the quote. When I was a young man, and I believe this is Rav Chaim Ozer telling it to Rabbi Weinberg, I thought that everything in the world was books. And now that I'm old, and now I'm reading from the Yiddish, translating from the Yiddish, helping a poor woman on Shabbos for the holidays, Dichtiga v'ala svarim is more important than all the books. And the author of this says that he wrote to Weinberg and said that when he repeated this story, people protested this. And Rabbi Weinberg wrote back to him a second time, it said, "Mi kamonish ohev svarim." Who like me loves books and authors? Ho ho amshali zerak svarim. And my entire world is only books. Ba'ani omer v'fev malei v'lev shalem yishar kol shehi pisa yitzot. And he says, "I tell you that it was good for you to write this." And then he goes on a little bit about this. So he gave an incredible statement. whether it's by Rabbi Chaim Ozer or by Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, that at the end of the day, however much we like books and we focus on Beis Medrash and all that, that's not the most important thing. And ironically, it's Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik that pointed out that he thought the most important thing about being a Rav was helping others. I realize that this is perhaps contradicted by passages that speak about Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam. Maybe another time we can discuss it. All I'm telling you is the story here, that at the end of the day, helping a person, helping the old widow or someone like that go through life, that's more important than the books. Since I mentioned Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg and Rav Chaim Ozer, here is a book, Lifrakim. We've spoken about it a few times. It's the book of Drashot and articles by Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg that he published himself when he was in Germany in 1936. It was then reprinted after his death twice. Now this is the third printing, and I mentioned how they censored it. They didn't include, for example, his eulogy on Esther Rubinstein. It's about this great Jewish learned woman. They didn't speak it, but they didn't include some of his antinomian stuff. I included that in the book I published. I just spoke about this a couple weeks ago. Eagle Eyes in the bookstore in Brooklyn called me last week and told me that they just came out with a third edition. It's actually not. A new printing of Lifrakim. It's actually, I believe it's the fifth printing. Well, maybe it is the third edition. It's the fifth printing of the new edition that came out 10 years ago. And there's new stuff in it, so I bought it. I figure maybe finally now they've included the stuff they censored. They didn't. But they have almost 200 pages of Divrei Torah, things of that nature, on Parshios HaShavua from Rabbi Weinberg, which various people sent in, things they heard from him in person. So it's worth having. But on page 733... tells an interesting story, which is also reprinted, by the way, by Rabbi Moshe Stern. Weinberg once came to visit Rabbi Chaim Ozer. And Rabbi Chaim Ozer told him Osukkas to go out in his sukkah, and the weather wasn't very good. And Rabbi Chaim Ozer, who wasn't feeling well, nevertheless, it came out to the sukkah. And even though it was raining, let me get the exact words here. Yeah, no, it was cold, very cold. And nevertheless, Rabbi Chaim Ozer comes out. And Rabbi Weinberg said to Rabbi Chaim Ozer, I can explain to you why you came out. He said that although you are a putter from being in a sukkah because it's cold and a mitzvah is putter from a sukkah, it doesn't say that a mitzvah is putter from Hachmasas Archi. Chaim Ozer agreed. Even if you're cold, you still have to show Hachmasas Archi. I mentioned about Rav Chaim Ozer's not really being a Zionist. In the letters of Rav Chaim Ozer, there's a letter to Levite Citron, who comes to Rav in Petach Tikva. He's a Mizrahi man. He's the son-in-law of the Rugachev. When we have classes on the Rugachev, I don't think we're going to have next semester, but we will have. I'll speak about the Rugachev's relationship to his daughter and son-in-law, because it is interesting that Rav Rugachev was a big opponent of Rav Zionism and Rav Kook. And then when his daughter marries Rabbi Citron and they go on Aliyah to Petah Tikva, he stops his anti-Zionism. They asked him about this, and he said it's because of his daughter. He's not getting involved anymore. And in this letter, he tries to, it's in the collective letters, he tries to discourage Rabbi Citron from going to Eretz Yisrael. He says you could stay in Russia, in Lithuania, you could accomplish a great deal. In Russia, actually, he's talking about. He even says you could be a Rav Mitam, a crown rabbi. Rabbi Citron was one of these rabbis who had a good secular education. And as I mentioned a few times, communities would prefer to have a crown rabbi who was also a spiritual rabbi. They wouldn't have to pay two salaries. A few of you asked me about this book by Shlomo Carlbach, and the name of it is Ish Yehudi. Ish Yehudi, and if you're interested, you can go to the website of Yitzchak, Yitzchok Levine, and on there's a section called Torah and Derech Eretz articles, TIDE articles, and you can get the excerpt of the Jewish Observer article I mentioned last class, which it's great that the very first page is an editor's note, which begins that many of us are accustomed to viewing the history of East European Jewry between the two world wars through the prism of the records of his great yeshivos and Torah giants. And then it goes on and talks about that this book deals with Torim Derech Eretz in in Lithuania. And it says, this review has been reviewed by Gedolei Torah and Rosh Yeshivos, who confirm the picture drawn by Rabbi Karlbach in his new work, and who encourage us to put his new historical insights before our readership. I mean, well, basically, like I said, this is in order to prevent them from being attacked from publishing something which really puts to rest the common misconception of what Lithuanian Jewry was like. So I have to give Yasha Koach to the Jewish Observer. But it's reviewed by Gedolei Torah and Rosh Yeshivas. Since when do Gedolei Torah and Rosh Yeshivas know anything about this? If they know anything about it, it's because they're historically minded. But the fact that they're Rosh Yeshivas has nothing to do with any this knowledge. And they can't confirm the picture from my Rabbi Karlbach. There are no Gedolei Torah, I believe, alive today who can even remember this from Lithuania. Maybe there's one or two, but I don't know of any. Rabbi Zolgetsi, maybe. So what it means when they say to confirm the picture drawn by Rabbi Karlbach, it means that they gave their approval. And then he has the chapter from the book also, that's Levine, which describes how, this is what he talks about, Tarim Derech Eretz, the Covenant Gymnasium, and page 76, there were 100 elementary, Tarim Derech Eretz elementary schools in the 1930s, throughout Lithuania. That's an enormous number. There was also high schools, gymnasium-style high schools in Telz, in Kovno, and Panevesh. The one in Telz is well-known. Many of the Telz Bachrim also went to this gymnasium. Great stories about Revolk from YU and his experience there. So I encourage everyone to see that. I have other things, but I see it's already late. I'm going to hold off on this till next semester. It can still hold. Good stuff from Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. If you go to HebrewBooks.org, you can print out for like $15 writings of thousands of figures, but including Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson. And there's some really great stuff from his commentary on Tractate Horayot. I will I'll bring that to you next semester. Don't need to deal with that now, because I do want to get to Ben Amozek. Just one thing, though. In his commentary on Rashi, which I also printed out, Nimuke Rashi. It's a great commentary on Rashi, three volumes. In the volume on Shmos, he published in 1930, he dedicates it to the memory of the Kadoshe Chevron. Very nice, and he sizes England. England is supposed to be a country that's based on tzedek and mishpat and socialism is all about equality. So therefore, England should recognize its mistakes and everything it's done. But right at the beginning, he says that what's responsible for this terrible massacre in Chevron? Avon tzaddikim v'chassidim mitnagdim u'shem shamayim levinyan siyim rishalayim. Yagudatam. And he goes on. He has spoken so often about these rabbis who like to blame everything. They know the reasons for all the tragedies. And they blame it on the irreligious and things like that. And what's good for the Jews is good for the gander. If we criticize them, here we have Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson doing the same thing, except he blames those Hasidim and Tzaddikim who are opposed to settlement of the land. It's because of their sin that were killed in Chevron. I guess that's better, though, than what that Mashkiach said, Rabbi Segel, that the reason that America's boys were killed was hastened. At least this way, he's saying that the reason that those people who settled in the land of Israel were killed was because of the anti-Zionists. Very similar to what Rabbi Teichtal would say later on. Some of you might find that interesting. I did want to tell you one more thing about Rav Avad Yosef and conservative conversions, but I'll save that for next class. Because I do want to at least include this class, whet your appetite for next semester, when God willing, we will pick up after the Chagim, and focus on an individual who I don't know if any of you have heard of. The other figure we dealt with from Italy, Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, I don't know if you heard of him either, but I trust that everyone thought he was fascinating. And the same thing with Eliyahu ben Amozik. Although Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan is mostly influential as a posek, a halachist, ben Amozik, who did deal in halacha. And he was really the leading Italian halachic figure at the end of his life. His influence is in other areas. He's one of those interesting figures who moderns have really rediscovered, as I said. Significant in his lifetime, but not overly so. And after his death, no one paid him any mind, as I said, for 80 years. But in the last 20 years, there's been a real revival of interest on him. And let me just give you an example here. There are two books that have come out in recent years about him. Find them here. I have so many things to show you on my page of for a different way. Here. Here's one. This is a translation of one of his books. It already appeared in Hebrew many years ago, about 30 years ago, I think, by Mossad Harav Cook. This is in English, with a very nice introduction. We'll speak about this book, published by Paulus Press, Classics of Western Spirituality. They publish classics of religion for all different religions. Has a wonderful introduction, a very long introduction by the translator of it. It was originally written in French, a man by the name of Luria, who I gather from his biography spent a lot of time in Tokyo. The other book, which just came out this year, up for you a second here. Sorry, wrong one. Philosophy and Kabbalah, Elijah ben Amozik, and the Reconciliation of Western Thought and Jewish Esotericism, as I said, published this year, 2009, last year, and there are numerous articles, all different aspects, looking at from Jewish law and philosophy, Kabbalah, all focusing on Eliyahu ben Amozik. So, is Eliyahu ben Amozik? In his time, he was actually referred to as the Plato of Italian Jewry. Where was he born? Well, he's born in the great city of Livorno. Here you have Livorno. Up here. There is Livorno, you see, right near Pisa. Here's Florence. These are the great cities. Padua, up here. And that's where he's born. Livorno has a long history. First of all, it's a port city. There was a printing press there. In fact, Ben Amozik has his own printing press. That's how he makes a living. Great rabbis have been in Livorno, as well as other cities in Italy. Sicily. So you all know the map of Italy. Livorno, known as Leghorn, depending on who was ruling it. He's born in 1832. In fact, today, there is a Ben Amozik Square in Livorno, Piazza Ben Amozik. That gives a sense of how important he was to the local Italian population in his time, because it was important, and he was very important for the Jews of Italy, although he did not have any sort of international importance. His father was 71 years old when Ben Amozik was born, had come from Morocco. As a child, we know that he studied Kabbalah intensively with an uncle who was a Mekubal. And as was typical in Italy, he received a very good secular education. The notion that you would only study Torah was not something that existed in Italy. It was expected that everyone would also get a good education, a good secular education. Just like today, we assume that you're going to get basic secular education. Even in the Haredi world, you'll learn math and English. In Italy, it was understood that anyone who's going to be a rabbi would have a very good secular education, just like in Germany. As a young man, he was already a fine Talmud Chacham. I'm going to show you now an introduction he wrote to his uncle Sefer, 16 years old. Here, first of all, is the book that his uncle wrote. Kabbalistic book called Ma'or Vashemesh. For some reason, his uncle did not, on the title page, didn't write Livorno. He wrote Li or Na. That's the book. And here is, I'll just show you a page of the introduction, what I mean by we see that his learning already at age 16. He writes an introduction. You can see from it the Sephardic approach, the Melitza style. Sephardim, unlike Ashkenazim, Sephardim were always expert in Tanakh, and they wrote in a way that very few Ashkenazim write. When I say Melitza, what do I mean by Melitza? Well, let me show you here. First of all, you see the name of his uncle was Yehuda. So every paragraph ends Yehuda. But look how he ends each section, each sentence. Yah, Shemaya, Shemaya, Revaya, Aliyah, Dishmaya, Anetuya. So there's this rhyming, and it continues on the next paragraph. Maalya, Dishmaya. This is obviously someone who, at the young age of 16, is really not just a Talmud Chacham, but a stylist, able to write in that beautiful poetic form. And try to read it. I mean, it's really very difficult. Second page of it, see how it ends. Sorry, again. Your average 16-year-old cannot write this way. Even a 16-year-old Talmud Chacham today, I don't know anyone who could write like this. But and there he is. Kol Hana'ar Eved Ivri. There he is. Eliyahu ben Hamozeg. Usually he writes it with an Aleph. Hamozeg. There you have. Eliyahu ben Hamozeg. The first thing from his pen that we have. Let's go on. In his 20s. He's hired to teach in the rabbinical school in Livorno. There were actually two rabbinical schools in Italy at this time. One in Padua, that's headed by his ideological adversary, Shmuel David Luzzatto. We're going to have classes on Luzzatto, but we're going to speak about him because Luzzatto was an opponent of Kabbalah, and Ben Hamozeg writes a whole book to polemicize against him. This book, Am Lashad. There's another rabbinical school, and that's in Livorno. And he's teaching there. He also is a dayan on the base of Livorno. And he opens a publishing house, which publishes a lot of books, not just Italian books. He publishes books from North Africa. For some reason, maybe because he had these connections in Morocco, North African rabbis almost exclusively publish their books in Italy. And Ben Hamozeg also publishes his own books there. Let me show you his own books. See the title page. Here's one. Yana Ba'esh, published in Livorno. And at the bottom, margin a little for you, see, Eliyahu, Bidifus Chadash, Chacham, Eliyahu ben Hamozeg Ubanav. Now, this is Dalet Tet Lamed. I don't know if anyone listening to us, we're just curious, anyone here want to send in what they think it is? It's one of these Rashi Tevot that I don't know, maybe someone else uses it, I'm not sure. But it means Dorish Tova Amo all the time. That's Ben Hamozeg. Although I find it difficult to believe, in one of the obituaries I saw, we're told that he only left Livorno two times. Let me show you the map again. One was a trip he took to Pisa. As you can see, it's very close, in 1846, only 12 miles away. Now, he had been 23 years old then, to meet the French Jewish philosopher Adolf Frank. I don't know if anyone knows the name today, anyone listening to us, the name's Adolf Frank, but I don't think he was an observant at all, very spiritual. He was, however, a student of Kabbalah. The title of the book he wrote, which you can find on Google Books, translated into, well, here it is, the Kabbalah. It's been reprinted and translated into various languages. It's probably the first book on Kabbalah written by a Jew, because there were some non-Jewish writers on Kabbalah. The first book written by a Jew in the vernacular. Here you see a recent reprint, but this is from the 19th century. And Amozig went to meet him. One of his greatest students, actually, and we're going to deal with him at the end of our discussions with him, was not Jewish. Near the end of his life, he met a Catholic theologian named Aimé Pallier. Pallier was unhappy with Catholicism and was thinking of converting. He was very impressed with the Italian rabbis he met. That itself is significant. Someone like Pallier would not have been impressed by rabbis in Eastern Europe and rabbis in Poland. But here he met a cultured rabbi, a rabbi who knew the New Testament, knew Christian doctrines, and he began to regard him as a teacher of sorts. And he becomes, what we have to say, is a Talmud Mufak, so much so that he wants to convert. And it's Ben Amozig who convinces him there's no need for you to convert. You can live as a Noahite. And if you go to Wikipedia, you will actually see a very long Wikipedia entry on Aimé Pallier. And we will deal with their relationship and what Pallier's doctrine was and how Ben Amozig influenced him. Ben Amozig is really the founder of this movement called Noachidism, being the notion of living as a Noahite. Well, let me just say, as long as I mentioned it, I'll say a few words now, and then when we get to Pallier, we'll deal with it in more detail. What Ben Amozig told Pallier was that the world needs monotheism. But not only from one perspective. There need to be a variety of experiences of monotheism. He told Pallier that rather than becoming Jewish, there's no need for you to become Jewish. You should preach a message of universal monotheism. You will not be bound to Jewish law, and none of the people you speak to will be bound to Jewish law. But they will also obviously not be bound to Christian dogmas. It will be a form of universal monotheism. Now, in the end, it never worked. Noachidism, however you want to pronounce it, the law of the Noahide, never took off. The Lubavitch also tried to push this. Why did it never take off? I think it's obvious why it never took off. Because what does it mean to be a Noahide? It means really recognize the law of Moses. You recognize the Torah, but the example I always give is, I quote Bialik, who said about translations, it's like kissing the bride through the veil. Being a Noahide is all about what you can't do. There's no positive religion. You can't even observe Shabbos. Kashrus has no meaning for you. You can't experience Judaism. Is it any accident that 99.99% of every non-Jew who's ever become convinced that Judaism is the true religion converts? Because if you want to, if you convince that this is the true religion, you want to have the whole thing. You want Shabbos. You want Kashrus. You want to learn Torah. All these things that are exclusively for the Jews. It's not a question of that you don't want to you don't have to do these things. Jews love to do the mitzvos. That's what makes, it's only the people who are not Orthodox. They see Shabbos as a burden. You can't phone, and they see halacha as a burden. For those of us who live the life, it's not a burden. Occasionally, you could have difficult times, so life is made difficult. But on the whole, it's the great gift that we have halacha. It's what structures our life. And over and over again, this is something that non-Orthodox cannot appreciate, that it's we don't look at it as a yoke. We don't look at it as something terrible. Today, in the modern world, no one's forcing us. Every one of us could be Mechal Shabbos next week. We don't have to observe it. No one's going to tell us what to do. And yet we choose to because we know the value of Jewish law and how important it is. So obviously, non-Jews gain an appreciation of Torah. They're going to want to have that also. They're going to want to be married to the Torah. The only way you can be married to it is by converting, even though we don't encourage conversion because there's no necessity to it. This is what they're going to do. So therefore, when people tell me about, there's this group in Tennessee who they call themselves Noahides and all this, I can't help but thinking they're eccentric people. They might be tzaddiki umos ha'olam, but eccentric. Because what kind of person, if he knows the truth, is going to want to remain outside? He's going to want to come inside. I think we should be very happy to find people who are Noahides who live good lives, but I don't think there ever was this assumption that Noahides would be people who recognized, despite what the Rambam says, recognized the Torah and said, nevertheless, I don't want to have a part of it. I'll be a Noahide. I think, for the most part, Noahides are people who live good lives, and they observe the Noahide laws. But anyone who recognizes that God gave the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu and that there's something special about being Jewish, I think it's only normal and natural that they too are going to want a part of that. But Palier was not just trying to create Noachidism in the sense that we think of it today. Like Lubavitch will tell people, there are seven laws, and they're all of the don't do variety. Don't do this, don't do that. Palier was also trying to create a positive religion of sorts. I think because for the reason I just gave, that it's not enough for people to live a life of not doing. Maybe some people can do that, but people who have a religious spiritual side, they want to have something that they also can do, not just things not to do. But what would a Noahide religion look like? Because there are no rituals. Rav Lichtenstein actually wrote about this some years ago in an essay, because the problem is the Rambam, in Hilchos Malachim, chapter 10, halacha 9, says that it's forbidden for non-Jews to create a religious system. Which means that for the Rambam, what does it mean forbidden? We're not controlling them, but he says it's forbidden. Obviously that means you can't teach them. And if they want to learn, you tell them that there can't be any religious ritual. They can't create, let's say, their own religious holidays, anything like that. Where he gets it is very problematic, because he derives it, apparently, or expounds the fact that the Talmud says that a Noahide cannot observe, a non-Jew cannot observe the Shabbos. Incidentally, the Rambam does not mention this in the Mishnah Torah. So some people were led to think that the Rambam didn't assume that this was halacha. And he was asked this question, and in a response to him, he says, no, it is halacha. A non-Jew is forbidden from observing Shabbos. And that's the reason we all know that when people are converting, the rabbi usually gives them one little thing to violate, to turn on a light or something like that. Although, if you recall, I mentioned that Rabbi Brisman from Philadelphia, from the basin of Philadelphia, in a response says that he doesn't accept this. He says there's no reason why someone who's going to be converting and is now learning about Shabbos has to violate it. And he says the Rambam is clear that we're talking about people who are creating their own religion. So he says if a non-Jew wants to Shabbos for their own purposes, for another type of religion, or even to be Jewish, then we say you're not allowed to. But if it's as part of learning what it means to be Jewish, and you have no intention here of creating your own religion or your own ritual, he claims that there's no reason why a future convert has to violate Shabbos. In any event, the Rambam says that he can't observe Shabbos, and he apparently, from here, derives also that he can't do any ritual. None of the other Rishonim, as far as I know of, say this. And Rav Lichtenstein doesn't really, he writes in a very delicate fashion, but he doesn't see, you get the sense he doesn't see, first of all, how this could at all be realistic. Because people have a need, a desire, to express their spirituality, their religiosity in certain ways. And you're going to tell people that they can't have any religion. The only people in the world who are allowed to have a religion are the Jews. The whole thing doesn't really make any sense. We're the only people in the world who can have a religion. Everyone else, they just can't worship idols, and they can't do this and can't do that, but they can't have any positive sense. How can you pass on any tradition that way? And what's wrong? Why shouldn't non-Jews have a tradition? So Rav Lichtenstein leaves no doubt that he inclines to the other position, not the Rambam's position, which he doesn't seem to see as having as something that we should even speak about or advocate. It doesn't work in the world today. And Ben Amozic also didn't adopt this, and Palier obviously didn't. He doesn't really go. Ben Amozic doesn't go into the details, and Palier was struggling to find what sort of this religion this would be, a religion, monotheism, because as I said, you need something sort of positive. Well, you could have, if you think about what a religion of universal monotheism would look like, perhaps it might look like the Unitarians, Salvation Army, maybe the Quakers, or some of the very liberal Protestant sects where your religious life is not played out in ritual or church services, but in service to your fellow man. But I'm thinking that that's perhaps how, if you wanted to be a stickler for the Rambam's position, could create a certain universal monotheism, like what exactly do Quakers do? Or do the Salvation Army or Unitarians? On the other hand, if you adopt the position of the other Rishonim, what could possibly be wrong with a monotheistic non-Jewish religion like Islam having a ritual that reminds them of God or a ceremony or anything like that? We'll return to this later when we deal with Palier. Many years later, remember I said that Ben Amozic in 1846, when he's 23, he goes to Pisa. Many years later, he returns to Pisa. time, again, only once, this time to attend a lecture at the University of Pisa, a lecture on the philosophy of law. Well, we're dealing with a person who never leaves his town his whole life. I don't know what to make of that, although not the only one. I don't know how many times Rav Yoshev has left his town. Many sources claim, if you look online, you'll find many sources that say that Kant never left Königsberg, the city of his birth, except to attend his father's funeral. Yet this appears to be a legend, because we do have evidence, I checked some of the biographies, that at least on a few more occasions he did leave, although it does appear that he never went more than 30 miles from his home. Miles or so, approximately 30 miles from his home. So I guess Ben Amozig is sort of like that. Now, we will come back to in greater detail what Ben Amozig has to say about other religions. For now, let me just call your attention to a book that is published, written in French, and it has been translated to Hebrew, but hasn't been published yet, although excerpts have, and was published, find it on my page here. It came out in the 19th century, I believe it's 1878. Find it here for you. Title page. Many things here. I think it's here. Published in English translation in San Francisco, 1873. So already people were taking notice of him. I don't have this copy. I have this one. Jewish and Christian Ethics. Published in the year 2000 by the Jewish Heritage and Roots Library of the Kest-Liebowitz Foundation. This is a group that was published about 500 svarim cheaply in small versions, limited printings, and soft cover. And on the title page of this book, the truth about the distortions and lies that Christian missionaries use to win over the unknowing Jew. In the back it says, the only Jew who is easy prey for Christian missionaries is one who is ignorant of his own rich heritage. This important book, a reprint from 1873, reveals the truth about the Christian hard sell of distortions and outright lies used to win over the unknowing Jewish souls. Let me just say this book has absolutely nothing to do with missionaries or anything at all like that. This is, I guess, a sales pitch to sell a book. Not only that, here's the title page of this book. Notice there's nothing in there. They took out the part about Islam. They only included the part about Jewish and Christian ethics. On the original title page, if you call, I'll show it to you. Why they left it out, I don't know. See, it also says, with a criticism on Mohammedism. Here they leave it out. Also, I will show you when I get to this book in more detail, they actually censor. Two places that I found where they censor what Ben Amozig writes. So he's important enough for them to publish the book and to talk about what an important book it is, but yet the students know more than the master, and Ben Amozig doesn't pass their haskama, so they take it upon themselves to censor him. When I say censor him, I mean I'll make copies for next semester. They actually, in the English section here, substitute their own lines. And if you look carefully, you see the print is not the same. And therefore, I went back to the original, and in one place they couldn't do it, so it's too long, and they actually tell you, editor's deletion. But the other place, you wouldn't know. They try to fool you. We'll get back to that. Basically, what he argues, and as I said, we'll talk in more detail, is that both Christianity and Islam are flawed because they only took one aspect from the Torah. Jesus took the moral and the spiritual side, but not the political side. And I'll explain later what he means by that. And Muhammad only took the legal and political side, not the spiritual side. What is Ben Amozig's major point of his writings? He wants to come to terms with Western thought. In this sense, he's very similar to Rabbi Soloveitchik. He wants to combine the truths of Western society with Jewish truths. isn't that really what Russell H. is doing? If you look at a Log Man, a Log Klein, things like this, he's trying to take the truths of philosophy and show how Judaism is better understood through them. That's what Ben Amozig wants to do, to combine Western society and Jewish truths. But Ben Amozig, what is the key? The key is Kabbalah. In fact, Ben Amozig is the last Italian Mekubal. And he is a Mekubal, a Kabbalist, in an era when the great Italian thinker Shadal and Reggio and others are anti-Kabbalah. He is the last great Italian Kabbalah. He ends a long and glorious tradition that has such a more important people as Emmanuel Chai Ricci, as Yosef Ergas, and of course, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And there is a Kabbalistic tradition that stretches all the way through, with Ben Amozig being the last Mekubal. Now, Guetta, who wrote the book that came out this year, he's a scholar in France, he points out that a big difference between Ben Amozig and his predecessors is that his predecessors, their aim, the Mekubalim, that is, was to disseminate Kabbalah and to reject philosophy. But the Ramchal attempts to join philosophy with Kabbalah in a way that Rav Moshe Israelis also tried to. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail on Ben Amozig's ideas. It's going to get very complicated. I'm not going to pretend even that I understand every last point that Ben Amozig is trying to make. First of all, you need to be an expert in Kabbalah. That is far from my specialty. Knowledge is fairly basic in Kabbalah. Furthermore, you need to be an expert in 19th century thought. That's also something where I have to say that I'm somewhat of a novice in I know enough, I think, to get the basic idea, but really to understand it, if you're interested, you read Guetta's book, it's very complicated stuff because 19th century philosophy, 18th century philosophy is very different than the medieval philosophy, the sort of stuff I'm trained in. Everything post-Kantian is very different. But I will present really some of the important ideas. And as I said, if you're interested, Guetta's book, I used it extensively. First of all, much of his writing is directed against Christianity. He's living in Italy. Jews in Italy are a small minority. And Italy is not like America. It is a Christian society. It's a Catholic society. For part of his life, Jews were still in the ghetto in Rome. It is suffused with Catholicism. Cathedrals on almost every other block, so you can't grow up Jewish in Italy without having a great understanding of what Christianity is. He has both a theological critique and what I will call a historical critique. And with the historical critique, in a sense, we come back to what we saw with Berkowitz. And this is what he deals with in this book a lot, and next semester we'll deal in more detail. That as far as the practical values of Christianity, the good morality of Jesus, he has no problem admitting the good things in Christianity, good moral teachings. And if you recall, when I dealt with Berkowitz, I said that even the doctrine, when Berkowitz speaks about how everything good in Christianity morally comes from Judaism, I said the Berkowitz doesn't deal with turn the other cheek. I said, but I bet you can find rabbis who would even say that. That was before I had read this book. Ben Amozig is going to argue that even turn the other cheek, which is the archetypal Christian idea that so many Jews are fond of making fun of, and saying that's not a Jewish idea, he says even that is a Jewish idea. Basically, his point is that nothing of value in Christian ethics is original. It all comes from Judaism. And whatever is original is bad. That is, to Hebrew, Masha Chadash Eino Chidush, whatever is new in Christian ethics is not a Chidush, is not really new. And Masha Chidush Eino Tov, and what is their own novelty is not good. That's really his point. From a theological perspective, that's where things get really interesting. One of the great problems of Christianity, and why, as far as Jews are concerned, and why the Trinity, in particular the Incarnation, is such a heresy, is that Jesus is both man and God. I've mentioned already, I wrote about it on the Sfarim blog, how I do not believe that the Trinity is a heretical doctrine, is a heretical viewpoint. There is no question that the Trinity could be justified in ways just like the Sfirot and Kabbalah are justified. In fact, the Yehuda Lei Aryeh Mimodna, 16th century Italian scholar, in his anti-Christian book, Magin V'Cherev, admits that the Trinity, we really wouldn't have a problem with the Trinity. Of course, the Rambam would have a problem with the Trinity, Yosef Albo, but the Rambam and the rest of them would also have a problem with the doctrine of the Sfirot. What Modna says, and what I believe to be true, is it's not the Trinity that's the heresy, it's the second person of the Trinity, incarnation. The idea that God assumes human form, that now God is a human, is an actual physical person. That's the heretical doctrine. If all Christianity was three persons, and these were three persons in heaven, not on earth or anything, then how is that different than saying there's Chachma and Bina and Tiferet, Malchut, all that? You could come up with a system, because it's three, but it's also one. And the Mekubalim say there's ten and they're also one. But without question, come up with a doctrine that fits in very well with Judaism in speaking of the Trinity. But once you say that it's not just the Trinity, like a heavenly, spiritual Trinity, God is divided into three parts, but one of them actually is separate, assumes human form, then obviously this is idolatry, Jews. It's idolatry for Christians, that's the old debate, whether that's a permissibility for Christians, but for Jews, it's without question idolatry. Not only that, as far as Jews are concerned, it's stupidity. Because you're worshiping a human being. So I think for the typical Jew, you ask the typical unlearned Jew in medieval times or in the East European shtetl, what's so terrible about Christianity? I don't think he would say, I'm talking about the rabbi here, the intellectual, I'm talking about the typical ignorant Jew. And most Jews were ignorant. I don't think he would say it's Avodah Zarah. What does he know about Avodah Zarah? I think fundamentally the thing that would offend him most is the idea that people are worshiping a person. That you're going to bow down to an individual and think he's God? I mean, that's stupid, they would say. And to be stupid is a lot worse than being sinful. I mean, I think that's how Jews thought. If you read the literature and you see how Jews just, it boggled their mind that intelligent people could believe in something that in their mind was just nonsense to worship a human. Things are not so simple when you deal with Ben Amozi, because he realized that they're very intelligent people, and it's a theological doctrine, but obviously there's going to be a great critique. Incidentally, the Chafetz Chaim acknowledged that great intelligent people who are Christians, most of the greatest minds in history have been Christians. So you can believe anything. I don't know if it's a fair criticism, because our doctrines also can be made to look very foolish. But the Chafetz Chaim was asked famously why he is so opposed to Mizrahi. He was very opposed to Mizrahi as a movement, although he, on personal basis, he was very friendly with some Mizrahi Rabbani. He even told Rabbi Reines, if you join Mizrahi, that'll be it for you in the yeshiva world. So I asked him, why are you so opposed to Mizrahi? There are great Talmidei Chachamim, Ole Yisrael, who are supporters of Mizrahi. And the Chafetz Chaim replied, there are great geniuses and scholars who believe in Christianity. Point being that intelligent, learned people, great sages, could be 100% wrong, just like they could believe in Christianity even though they're intelligent. These great Torah scholars could also believe in Mizrahi, but that doesn't make it right. It just shows you that great scholars, great Torah scholars, could also be 100% wrong. And what's the proof of that? People were saying, well, they're great Torah scholars. How could you say they're 100% wrong? It's just a difference of opinion. He says, there are plenty of great Christian scholars, and we certainly say they're wrong, so why can't we say that great Jewish scholars are wrong also? So what is Ben Amozi? Yes, William, were you with us? We discussed this in detail. Was it this semester or last semester? Anyone remember? I said that this is actually quoted. I heard this when I was in yeshiva. This was famous. And we all assumed it was a joke, the Rav's great sense of humor. You know, he's asked a question, and he says, you heard it live. Okay. And I thought it was so funny that Rav Schachter, who heard it also, he took it very seriously. Maybe Rav Schachter. But I always assumed it was a joke. And Rav Schachter actually includes it as actual halacha. What's the difference between a joke and halacha? I think if you'd ask the Rav, is it really a sir? I don't think he would say it is. I don't know. So what's the great problem with, we said, it's the Trinity and Incarnation. It's such a heresy because Jesus is both man and God. And our Moses explains. Yeah, but the question is he saying this as a psak halacha or is he saying it as a joke? It could be a psak halacha, but the way it was always said when I heard it was that this was the Rav's great sense of humor. So one of these lines he gave. Okay, psak, I take back what I said, but it's not just me. We all assumed it was a joke. That's how it was told. Anything stupid is usher? Okay, I don't know. It might be usher. It's not a avodah zarah, though. Maybe you say that. It's usher to be stupid. But, William, if you explain to the Rav why they do it, that it's about kavod for your teacher and all that, then it wouldn't be stupid. The way the story is, they told the Rav this, and he didn't understand why they would do something like that, so he says it's stupid. But it's not stupid. There's a reason you bow down. So if there's a reason, anything that has a reason is not chukos agoyim. That's one of the ways you can explain when you can adopt non-Jewish practices. If it has a reason, if it doesn't have a reason, you're not allowed to. So Ben Amozik says, typing, there is, according to Ben Amozik, there's supposed to be a tension between the real and the ideal, between in Kabbalah, between Malchut and Tiferet. What's Malchut? Malchut is the feminine side of the Godhead. And Tiferet is the masculine side. These are supposed to be separate. Remain separate. And although there is a zivug, it's called, a coupling, Malchut and Tiferet come together, wherever you want to interpret this, they are not identical. They keep their separate nature. However, in Christianity, as Moses is arguing, separateness is made identical. That is, humanity, the human, the physical being, is made identical with the Father, the spiritual being. And Ben Amozik sees this as really a distortion of true religion in which you need to keep these sorts of things separate. The union, this union, the ideal union of where everything comes together and becomes one, is never supposed to be achieved. And I'm going to explain in more detail what I mean by this. But in Christianity, the union is achieved. Man and God are unified. That's no good. And Amozik goes further and says that you have anti-Trinitarian forms of Christianity. Unitarianism is one. Early in the church, you had various anti-Trinitarian forms of Christianity. He argues that we see in this the influence of Judaism, in particular, Kabbalistic Judaism. And I'll explain what he means by this. He goes so far as to say that the non-Trinitarian heretics, there were Christians who were non-Trinitarians who were executed from ancient times, even up until the year of the Inquisition. He says those people should be viewed as martyrs by us and venerated as such. These non-Trinitarians that the church killed were martyrs for the sake of God's true nature. For monotheism, and we must venerate them, respect them. Can you imagine Holy Israel saying that those Christians who were killed by the church for rejecting the doctrine of the Trinity because they were preachers of a true monotheism, which is God's religion after all. True monotheism is God's religion. They died al kiddush Hashem, and we must venerate them as martyrs, just like we venerate Rabbi Akiva and our martyrs. Incredible statement, but makes perfect sense. Ben Amozik, despite his strong criticism of Christianity, and we'll see it even more detail, he does show a great deal of tolerance to it from a certain respect. Also, obviously, to Islam, he shows great tolerance. He sees them, and what I mean by tolerance, he sees them, even with their doctrine of the Trinity, he sees them as qualified for ger toshav status, because he adopts the view of the Ramah that Christians, non-Jews, are permitted to believe in shituf, that is, permitted to split the Godhead, believe in one God, divide the different parts, even though it's wrong, and it destroys the true notion of God. He says it is still an appropriate doctrine, an acceptable doctrine for them, halachically. He goes further, discussing the martyrs. He says, who choose, even though they're permitted halachically to adopt shituf, they choose not to in their martyr, and their martyr, he says, they do not have to martyr themselves. He elaborates on the notion that there is no idea of Kiddush Hashem for non-Jews, only for Jews. A Jew is obligated to die, killed, rather than worship idolatry. A non-Jew is not permitted. So all these martyrs were not actually obligated to die al Kiddush Hashem. He goes further. He has a whole piece that Rabbi Batal Naor has an article dealing with non-Jews, in particular the Ger Toshav, Ben Amozig's thoughts. Ben Amozig, for example, checks the Talmud. Talmud states that non-Jews are not commanded to have children. So, pru or vu. And we can understand why this would trouble Ben Amozig, because he wants to see non-Jews, who are Noahides, as basically having the same basic obligations as Jews. And what's more basic than having children and spreading God's name? So, therefore, he says, in this matter, we accept there are certain Kabbalistic texts and other sources, there might even be a Midrash, but there's definitely Kabbalistic sources he cites, that say that non-Jews are obligated to have children. There is a mitzvah of Pur of Hu. And Ben Amozig says that's the opinion we adopt. The flip side to this. Therefore, the whole Catholic doctrine of monasticism and celibacy is also shown by Ben Amozig to be a distortion of true Noachidism. Because there's no doctrine. As long as you have this idea that non-Jews are not obligated in pru or vu, then what's wrong with living a celibate life? You might say it doesn't make sense, it's a bad lifestyle, but you can't really oppose it theologically. Ben Amozig wants to oppose celibacy and the whole Catholic notion of the priesthood and monasticism theologically. And therefore, he wants to say that it's by not having children, you're violating God's wishes. God wants you to have children. He even goes so far as to see Christians, non-Jews, resting on the Sabbath, whatever day they want to make it, as a very positive thing, because the Ger Toshav was commanded to rest on the Sabbath. If you recall, the rabbis tell us that Israel was commanded to write the Torah. Remember, we were supposed to write the Torah on stone in 70 languages. And it's derived from a verse, Deuteronomy, it says, you shall write upon the stone all the words of the law very plainly, by our heitev. This, to him, is a proof, if it has to be written in 70 languages, that we have an obligation to teach the world certain things about the Torah. All Jews have an obligation. For example, creation of the world, the Exodus, anything that will teach the Gentiles how to best live as a Noahide, we must teach them. We must teach them about God's providence, about the oneness of God, about reward and punishment. Then Amozig perceives Chabad in his missionary notion that the Noahide laws must be spread across the world. He himself, but it was a job of his student, Palyeh, to do it. Chabad, I don't know if they still do this Noahide stuff. They did. A Chabad guy contacted me in Scranton a couple of years ago. He wanted to come speak to the students. And I told him no, I couldn't have him come speak to the students about the Noah. So why not? For the simple reason, I have no problem about, in general, about speaking to non-Jews, but I can't be seen in my role teaching at a Catholic university sponsoring a speaker who's going to come in and tell them how about, it's one thing to talk all about the Noahide laws, that's great, and Christians believe they follow them. But I know Chabad's viewpoint when it comes to Christianity. All it takes is a question, and these people are not always the most discreet or the most sense. All it takes is one question about Jesus or anything like that, and he's going to start telling them that it's idolatry, it's forbidden for you to worship Jesus, and I needn't tell you that that would create great problems. I'm sponsoring an event where a Jewish speaker is coming in and trashing Christianity. I didn't even sponsor some guy who converted from Catholicism to Judaism wanted to come to the University of Scranton and speak about this, and I couldn't have that. How can I have someone speak about all the terrible things he thought in Christianity and why he left it for Judaism? They regard him as an apostate, and it wouldn't be good manners, and it wouldn't if they're being nice enough to host a Jewish person like me and allow me to teach subjects and all that. This isn't a secular university, so I said I couldn't do that. He says, one more minute, he says that the nations, Ben HaMosek, are not commanded in the mitzvot, but if they want to take the mitzvot upon themselves, they can. And the Rambam actually says so in Hilchos Malachim. Although the Rambam says you can't create rituals like holidays or anything like that, if you want to take more mitzvot upon you, look in chapter 10, Halacha 10, you can. There are certain exceptions. You can't do Shabbos, you can't learn Torah, but in general, you can. And Ben HaMosek tells us this is how the Avos, the patriarchs, lived. They were not commanded in the mitzvot. They took them upon themselves. In other words, Noahides can adopt those mitzvot that will be of value to them. So a Noahide that wants to observe Shabbos or Kashrus, go ahead and do that. It's going to be spiritually valuable for you. And I'll conclude by saying, though, that this is the role of the Jewish people vis-a-vis the world at large. The Bible says that we are a kingdom of priests. What does that mean, we're a kingdom of priests? How can we be? How can a whole people be a kingdom of priests? The whole notion is that you have a priest, and he stands as the go-between, between the people. He offers the karbanot, or in Catholicism, he's the real intermediary. He gives sacraments. So what does it mean that the Jews are a kingdom of priests? And we are Kohanim anyway. What it means is that we are a kingdom of priests for the rest of the world. Just like it's the job of the priests to go-between, to carry out certain tasks, certainly in the non-Jewish world, to do that. So too, that's the Jewish people's role. Every Jew is a priest. Every Jew has this function, to the world as a whole, to act as an intermediary, just like the priests do, to the people of the world, bringing to them the monotheistic message, the word of God. So just like you think of a Catholic Church, you think of the priest, and you think of the people, we, that is the Jewish people, are the priest to the entire world. And really, that's where we'll stop now. There's a lot more to say. When we pick up next semester, first of all, there's halachic debates he's involved in, debates over creation and other things. His notion of Kabbalah and its ancient origins and his polemic against both Modena and Shaddal we'll deal with. The Italian rabbinic scene and the Jewish scene, early reform in Italy, a lot of things we're going to get to next semester. A new book of his just appeared. One of the rabbis in Israel is a big fan of his. So a lot to say. We'll end here. I want to wish everyone, obviously, an easy fast, but a very good summer. Hopefully we'll all be able to pick up in the fall where we continue the Ben HaMosek. I plan to also do Rav Yosef Messas, Mayor Simcha of Dvinsk, the great Or Sameach, and I don't know, I thought of doing Yishai Leibovitz, but maybe I'll push him off. People asked about the Rugged Shover. I'm not sure. I do want to do Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, though. Maybe Rav Aaron Cutler. I still haven't thought about it, so if anyone has any suggestions, please feel free to email them. Let me say again, it was a pleasure. I enjoyed every class. Thank you so much for the comments. Thank you to those who've been emailing me offline. William, if you send me an email, I'll give you a very interesting source I just found dealing with Ben HaShmashos and a discussion which I think is quite original from a different angle. You can tell me if I'm right. Any final comments or questions on what we've done so far? I hope some of you didn't feel that we took too long in Rafael Moser Grzinski. I think part of the advantage of the format we have here is that there's really no, we don't have a limit, a time limit. It's not like a 50-minute lecture where I have to finish. If I don't finish now, we go on. So if we get involved in tangents, if we discuss different things, if instead of taking us 3 weeks, it takes us 5 weeks, it doesn't really matter because this is now 4 years, almost 100 lectures. This is a continuing series, and we just keep going on. My email address is shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. When I go off, I'm not going to come back on, so just send me an email, and I'll send you the link. I'll make a PDF for you if you need. Why was Shaddal opposed to Kabbalah? In detail, we'll have to wait till we deal with Shaddal. I'll do a class on Shaddal. We will discuss it a bit when I talk about this book, Tom Washad and Ben HaMosek's Attack Against Shaddal. Let me show you the title page of it here. And then I'll just give you in I guess the question, Yisrael, is how much you know about Kabbalah. Here's the title page of the book. Let's hold off on that till next semester, because I'm going to talk about Ben Amozig's notion of monotheism, which I think will blow your socks off when you hear it. Basically, when you start learning about Kabbalah, many people are shocked because they had certain conceptions. They thought that we were all monotheists, sense pure monotheist, that God is unique and can't be divided, and that there's one God. And then you hear about, of course, there's one God, but he has different aspects. The vision of a sort in the Godhead, for many people, this is a great shock. They never heard of such a thing. And we'll see what Ben Amozig develops the idea that for the masses, because the masses can't be exposed to Kabbalah, for the masses, the notion of God is a simple God. However, for the adepts, those who've been initiated into Kabbalah, you see that God is not a simple God. And there's actually a Godhead which has different parts. And so everything you're taught as a child and everything you hear in Shul isn't necessarily correct. Kabbalah initiates you into a different concept of God. So that's all you need to know, that why someone like Shaddai would be opposed to it. He thinks that it's desecration, really, of God idea. And other things as well. He's not the first opponent of Kabbalah, but by the time he comes to Shaddai, most people had either accepted Kabbalah happily or said that we are only Yasek and Istar, have nothing to do with it, but it's at least it's a holy science. Shaddai was very opposed to it. Also opposed to different aspects of Kabbalah, the Zohar. It's a very different type of Judaism than the Maimonidean Judaism, which he didn't like either. Shaddai wanted a biblical Judaism. But we'll see that for Ben Amozig, Kabbalah is actually the key to not just understanding the Torah, to understanding life, and to understanding non-Jewish religion. And we'll deal with that in more detail. Now, Shaddai was opposed to Kabbalah. He studied it when he was young. His father was a student of Kabbalah. Shaddai thought that Kabbalah was heresy. He was opposed to studying it, to teaching it, to everything. He thought it was nonsense. He thought it was a terrible thing. The Italian rabbinate did have its own style. It was not just Sephardic, although it was very close to Sephardic in many of their practices. We will see Ben Amozig has a big battle with the Sephardic rabbinate. In Syria, actually, they burn his book. Eimla Mikra. A big machokas breaks out, but it was another Sephardic rabbi, Rechaim Palachi, that comes to his defense. The Italian rabbis were sui generis, very well secular educated. The Sephardic rabbis didn't have secular education. These were rabbis who were real Renaissance people. Just think of people like the Ramchal, who wrote poetry and plays. Think of the Vadya Sforno, who instructed non-Jews in Torah. The Italian rabbinate is unique. And it really ends in the 19th century. Ben Amozig is not just the last Kabbalist and the last Halachist. He is the last of the Italian rabbinic tradition. By the beginning of the 20th century, by the end of the 19th century, you don't have this great Italian rabbinic tradition anymore, a combination of Torah and secular, of humanism. These were all people who could cite to you, they knew art, and it was a different type of rabbinate, very similar to Germany, incidentally. But it was much more of a humanist oriented, of the Italian type of humanism in a Catholic environment. So they were not Sephardic style located in Italy. Very different. Robert Bonfil, Ruvain Bonfil, has written a good deal about the Italian rabbinate. And we'll see some more. Just to give you an example, wait till we get to the conflict over cremation in Italy. Yisrael, there were rabbis in Italy who supported cremation. Chief Rabbi of Rome's body was cremated and buried in a Jewish cemetery. Ben Amozig fought against this, but you never could have had such a thing in the Sephardic world. These rabbis in Italy were coming up with their own ideas in a way that no other, and these were traditional rabbis in a way that you don't have anywhere else in the world. And after we get through I think you'll understand what I mean when I say it was not Sephardic. It was a very hospitable country, Italy. Although it was obviously a Catholic country, Jews much of Italy were given great freedoms to participate in intellectual life, and the Italian rabbinate never, even when they were in the ghetto, they were persecuted in certain areas. But this idea that you need to segregate yourself from non-Jewish, I don't really have an answer why. You'd think that they were segregated, but there was never really the persecutions, the terrible expulsions and the massacres. They were always able to enlighten themselves. And what's important, I think, we saw this with Chazan, even when they were living in the ghetto, the intellectual Catholics, the priests who were intellectual, the professors at the university, were very interested in having a dialogue with the Jews. So there was an opening for them to express themselves. They didn't attend the university so much. At some points they did. Yitzhak Rompronti, in the 17th century, he went to the University of Padua. He became a doctor. But for the most part, Jews were not involved in academic life. But I guess it's like in Germany. It was an environment where Jews permitted, at least unofficially, to interact intellectually and culturally with non-Jews. And it didn't die out. Germany is different. Germany, this form of Judaism develops in the 19th century under Hirsch. In Italy, this was the form of Judaism that really arises in Renaissance Italy, when everything was open for Jews, and the Jews could take part in anything they wanted to. And then, even with the Counter-Reformation, when things become more difficult for the Jews, this tradition, this enlightened Italian rabbinic tradition, never dies out. Part of the reason, I think, is because the persecution was never really that strong, although there was persecution, and also this sense of this love and appreciation for secular learning, for poetry, for Hebrew language, it was so strong that it just remained part of Italian life. I see William's typing something. I don't know if he's typing to me or just typing. I'll remain on one more minute or two more minutes, and I will say goodbye to you all until we meet again. I see Charles typing as well. Oh, you're saying the Italian rabbis. Was he an Italian? The Minchas Kohen, where was he from? He has an Italian name, but was he in Amsterdam or Italy? There's a Sefer, really one of the most important Sfarim. I think William can correct me. He was Amsterdam Sephardic. I wonder if you say that they studied it into the modern era. Were there any Sfarim written on Kiddush HaChodesh by the Italians? That I don't know. Have on HebrewBooks.org a very interesting book by rabbis called Hoil Moshe, Biblical Commentary, not of the sort that you see in Eastern Europe, which is very rabbinic. This is shot biblical commentary written in the 19th century. He published, I think, about six, maybe seven volumes of biblical commentary. HebrewBooks.org only has a few of the volumes. One of them they do have is the Perush on the Chamesh Megillos. If you want to take a new Perush to show when they're reading one of the Megillos, you can see the Hoil Moshe. You can print it for $15 or $12. You can print it from HebrewBooks.org. It's a Peshat-oriented commentary. How many people are doing Peshat-oriented commentary? You have the Netziv and the Ketav Kabbalah, but this is it's very unusual. Some other Italian works. Oh, very interesting. Why did they chase the Ramchal out of there? Well, they didn't chase the Ramchal out of there because they were closed-minded. They thought that the Ramchal was a false prophet. Here was a youngster, a young man, who was receiving visions and was gathering around students, and they were saying that he was the greatest Kabbalist who was visited by Eliyahu and everything else. They thought that he was a false prophet, a Sabbatian, or maybe he was a Sabbatian, or all sorts of things. You can read Elisheva Karlbach's wonderful, wonderful book on Moshe Chagiz, and you can see the great Rabbanim who chased the Ramchal, but it had nothing to do with them not being open-minded. They just thought that the Ramchal was a crazy man. Very nice. He's the Minchas Kohen. Ramchal, he traveled, he went places. He was eventually able to find a community that accepted him. wasn't easy for the Ramchal. Amsterdam also was a very open place. And the Ramchal, by the way, had followers in Italy. There was plenty of time in Italy where he lived a fine life, and he wasn't interfered with. But it was an extremist, I don't want to call him extremist. There was a rabbi in Venice, one of the leading rabbis. He didn't like the Ramchal very much. He had it out for him. He led the charge. He had Moshe Chagiz. He had others. So okay, we should, William, maybe I should speak. I'm going to speak to Rabbi Kelman. I think maybe we should ask you to give a class or two on the essentials of Kiddush HaChodesh, or what you're working on, the Bein HaShemasha, with the technology we have here. You could show us maybe some astronomical charts. I think that would be a very good idea. So, if you don't want to do it, send me an email. If I don't hear from you, I'm going to suggest to Jay that when everything picks up in the fall, I know he's looking to organize, maybe yet to hear you, if not for for one or two classes where you present on this. Very good. So if you can put it into one or two classes, I think a lot of people would really like to hear, because something that very few people know about is the calendar. And just to give you one example before we end. When I was growing up in my town, William, Shabbos was never ended after like 9:17. That was the latest. Shabbos ended 42 minutes after sunset. That's when it ended. I come back to my town. This is Western Orange, New Jersey, after being away for like 20 years in college and everything. And now, all of a sudden, last week, Shabbos ends 9:24. And I've already lived here now 10 years. So Shabbos is ending 9:20, 9:24. And growing up, it never ended this late. Now they're ending it, I think it's 52 minutes after sunset. So I asked the person why, and he says, well, that's the calendar they give him. Just the very question is, how do we know when Shabbos ends? Like, why is the calendar different today than it was 20 years ago? Is there one calendar that everyone goes to? They all go online now, and they say this is the calendar. So when some guy decided that from now on, Shabbos will be 52 minutes instead of 42 minutes, I mean, I don't think people understand something which we celebrate every week, Shabbos, how we know when Shabbos ends. Never mind how you know when Shabbos begins. When you talk about it, if we have you online, I'll try to arrange that, throughout most of our history, people were starting Shabbos well after sunset. I mean, these are the sorts of things that the average person knows nothing about, and obviously know a great deal about it, so I certainly look for yes, but you say it's 10 minutes longer. It was never 10 minutes longer when I was young. I know for a fact that it never ended 9. It always ended, even in the summer months, 3 minutes, an hour and 3 minutes after they started Shabbos. And someone decided to change it. I'm not sure who it was. It's in the calendar. It's not in the calendar, in many of the calendars, when Shabbos ends. It's when it starts. But if you go to the places online and other things, now they have it this way. It was not this way. I remember very vividly my whole life, because I knew when Shabbos ended. An hour and 3 minutes after candlelighting. And when I came back, someone said in the previous rabbi they changed it, but they say every child has a slightly different time. Where they get the time, though, I don't know. If you're going to say 42 minutes, okay, then I don't need to go to the website. I can tell you. But in my town now, no one is ending Shabbos 42 minutes. Yeah, the Chasam Sofer says, I believe it's 30 minutes. That ties into the censorship of the Chasam Sofer that I deal with in my book. But not just the Chasam Sofer. In Eretz Yisrael, they ended, as you know very well. Okay, so I will see what I can do to have a class about this. I look forward to it. Again, thank you all. It's been a very wonderful semester. Look forward to seeing you all again. Hold on, Eva's typing. I'll hold off one more second. Sometimes if you're connected and you're typing something else, even if you're sending an email to someone, it'll show up on my screen. I don't know if you could see it, but I could see it, that someone's typing. It says that Eva's typing, so I'll hold off one second since it's not showing up on my screen. I'm assuming, Eva, that you're not typing for me. So, therefore, good night, everyone.